Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Tulsa Symphony Orchestra gets underway in the new year with a program tomorrow evening featuring a less-heard symphony by Beethoven, the Symphony No. 4. My guest today, though, says if this work was written by any of Beethoven's contemporaries, it would be played more and recognized as the great composition it is. It only suffers in comparison to other Beethoven. Principal guest conductor Daniel Heggie leads the TSO in that piece, along with Mendelssohn's Hebrides Overture and two works by Maurice Ravel, Le Tombeau de Couperin and Cigan, the latter which features the orchestra's principal violinist, Rosita Gosa. The concert takes place tomorrow evening at 7:30 at the Chapman Music Hall, and principal guest conductor Daniel Heggie joins me today to preview the performance. Daniel Heggie, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, great to be here, Rich.
I guess the orchestra getting off to a start in the new year with this program, which features Ravel, Mendelssohn, and Beethoven.
Yes, now, great combination.
So what is great about that particular combination?
Well, especially if you think about, let's just take Ravel, the two works we're doing, Le Tombeau de Couperin and Cigan, and then compare that to Beethoven. Those are just two great pieces that contrast in so many different ways. You have the Ravel, very French and a kind of a much different kind of way of playing and being expressed, and yet very tonal and rich with colors. And then you have the Beethoven, which is very German. It's very jocular and happy. Not that the Ravel is bleak or anything. It's also very optimistic in a way. But they're just two incredibly contrasting works. And then the Mendelssohn at the beginning is a very poetic way to start and kind of frames the concert with the
brooding.
Beethoven.
I always thought of the Hebrides as sort of a brooding sort
it,
of.
It is.
Yeah.
In that really intense way, I oftentimes think that that work is like one of the most beautifully crafted works. It's only about 10 minutes long. It just has this, like I said earlier, poetic way of kind of distilling the most important ingredients in a piece of music, because it has all of the drama, but it has that brooding quality too, and just gorgeous melodies that we would expect from Mendelssohn as well. But a brilliant way to start the concert.
When we talk about the Hebrides Overture, people of a certain age would know it as Fingal's Cave.
Yes.
And it is supposed to be this depiction of this Scottish cave, right?
That's right. Yeah, it's something that, you know, when Mendelssohn was like 20 years old, I mean, he was able to go on this trip and just off the northwest coast of Scotland, able to see these beautiful rocks kind of jutting out as part of the Hebrides Islands there. And he was just struck by how regal and grandiose it was. He said even more so than a cathedral, and wanted to write about this. And it, over the course of about 5 years, I mean, he was able to write very quickly. So he started when he was 20 and finished it off when he was 25. But the piece, it also sounds actually like it's depicting water, like crashing off rocks. So it's that kind of undulating factor that in the music that kind of sounds like waves of the sea. And I think he was just so struck by it that was the real inspiration behind it.
And that idea of the waves crashing almost gives it a, not minimalistic, but there is a bit of minimalistic sort of
yes.
thought behind it. Of
yeah.
this repetitive motif that just keeps coming mm-hmm. over and over again. Sometimes it's minor, sometimes it's major. And
that's
it's just,
right.
And it just keeps rolling over and over, just like a wave.
It's right. And it kind of starts off as a theme, but then it actually is used as a motive underneath other themes. So he's able to kind of bring in this kind of counterpoint where he plays some of the beautiful themes over the top and it just keeps churning underneath. So it's just just an amazing piece in terms of its craft.
Do you think of the sea when you're conducting it?
Not really. I mean, a little bit, only in the sense of just kind of trying to get the mood. But I think that sometimes we have to be a little bit careful, when we're interpreting music to say this is that. It isn't actually that. I mean, it's inspired by that. And then this is what we have after it. I think it's a gateway into thinking what it's really about, a certain kind of turbulence, let's say, that can be something in life or a different idea. But if you start with that, it's very pictorial, of course, and it can kind of give a nice idea about the nature of the piece. But I think that's the point of departure. Then I think it opens up to a whole world.
What are the other things you have to think about when you're doing Mendelssohn? What was for Mendelssohn as opposed to any other romantic composer of the 19th century?
Well, Mendelssohn really was firmly looking backwards as well. I mean, he's one of the ones very much responsible for the revival of Bach's music. And you can see he's a romantic figure, but his music is very classical as well. So he stands right on that borderline of using kind of classical forms and classical structure, classical kinds of phrasing that would look slightly back from where he is. But he's also very romantic in the kind of idea and the way he puts forth musical ideas. And so he's looking forward at the same time. So I think that you have to kind of keep that all in mind when interpreting it. And it's not just this lush, romantic music, but it has also a kind of classicism to it as well, especially in the form, the structure. He definitely is looking at the classical forms.
When I think of this overture, I think of how popular it was, say, in the first half of the 20th century. You heard it all over the place.
Yeah.
Now you don't hear it as much. What do you suppose that is?
I don't know. I mean, I think certain pieces, they simply are in vogue for a while, and everyone's just like, you know, catching on to it. And then as time goes on, there are some other pieces that catch people's fancy and gets programmed more, and people say, oh, I'm going to do that. And then that, and it's not because the other piece has fallen out of favor that it's not performed as much. It's just that there are other pieces there and people kind of gravitate towards those. And then sometimes the piece comes back. There's some violin concertos like that, you know, that suddenly everyone wants to be playing them because someone started doing it or there's a great recording that came out of it. And then it kind of falls by the wayside a little bit and something else comes in. So it may have been something as simple as that.
I also think in its particular case, it has been appropriated for use in other ways, in so many ways. It has
commercial
so many
ways and
it has
things.
Yeah, it has some, I don't want to call it baggage, but it conveys different things than probably it was actually written to convey.
Yeah, right. Like extra musical kinds of things that aren't just about the music itself, but it's a backdrop for something else. And yeah, sometimes people stay away from things like that a little bit. But I think that's sometimes a reason to do them, to do pieces like that, because for the listeners, they're struck by how familiar they are with it. But then they're hearing it as pure music and like, oh, I know this. You know, this was used in the theme music for something else. And I know this. And that's sometimes how we find a lot of classical music is ubiquitous in our culture. Mm-hmm. So it's good to perform it just as it is.
Well, let's hear a little bit of the Hebrides Overture by Mendelssohn, one of the pieces to be performed by the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra this Saturday evening at 7:30. That's music by Mendelssohn, who will be performed by my guest today, principal guest conductor of the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra, Daniel Heggie, who will be leading the orchestra in two works by Ravel, along with the Beethoven Symphony No. 4, this Saturday evening. Really, what's interesting about the Ravel on the program is it's two very contrasting pieces of Ravel.
Mm-hmm.
You have Ravel in his very late romantic, typically French mood with the solo piece, Zigane.
Mm-hmm.
And really invoking modernism with the other piece, Le Tombeau de Couperin.
Yes. And in fact, with Le Tombeau de Couperin, we have four of the movements that he actually orchestrated. You know, he wrote it for piano earlier in 1917. And it was really a dedication to some of his friends that he lost in World War One. He really wanted to do something in World War One, but he was so small and kind of frail that he couldn't actually go out and fight. And so he did try to work wherever he could, you know, as medic and things like that. But he thought there was another way he could give back, and that was through the music. So he wrote it as a piano work. Originally, it has a number of more movements than just the four. But he orchestrated these four, and tombeau actually means like tomb, you know.
Yeah.
So it's actually to say in memory. I mean, it's not dark in that
it's
sense.
It's a combination of tomb and homage.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
Yeah,
a dedication right. to those who have passed away, and a lot of times as a result of World War One. So, yes, he's definitely invoking 20th century techniques in terms of orchestration. But the other thing is that he's actually looking back to Baroque forms because this is Le Tombeau de Couperin. Yeah. Couperin, very famous French Baroque composer. So he's using these old Baroque keyboard forms.
And is he actually using melodies from Couperin or
it's
is it
really the style? I mean, he takes more like the motives and maybe a couple of the melodic motives and things like this, but he really makes it something his own. I mean, something like the Prelude, for example, which is this tour de force for oboe. It's a big excerpt piece for the oboe. It's very virtuosic in terms of the technical and musical challenges that are there. That's definitely Ravel and the way he orchestrates it. He uses all of these techniques that you would say they're kind of devised by him, people like him and Prokofiev, these master orchestrators, where they put just little tiny things in with even a very small orchestra. This is a fairly small orchestra. I mean, it'll have the full complement of winds, slightly reduced string section. But he's able to do it by combinations of instruments and by using harp and all the range of different things that harp can do, harmonics and the strings and different things they can do and different effects, special effects like play by the bridge or play more at the tip or over the fingerboard. And you create all of these different colors, which is something that's a more modern idea, but he's doing it with old Baroque forms.
And I think of Stravinsky, too, because Stravinsky was doing about the same thing at the same time. And we think of Puccinella as again, this look back, Respighi to a certain extent. They were all looking back 100 or 200 years.
There was a big turn towards the neoclassicism in general when we got into the 20th century.
So art as well.
Yeah, art as well. And you know what was happening to the orchestra is if you look back to times and then you start looking forward chronologically from there, the orchestra got bigger and bigger and bigger. So Baroque is just a few players, classicals. Like now you have a little symphony like Haydn or Mozart. Then Beethoven expanded the size, and then we get into Schumann and Brahms and then Wagner and Berlioz
and then Mahler
and Bruckner.
We have these
massive, massive, massive orchestras coming right up to about the turn of the century, turn of the 20th century, early 20th century. And then people started to say to themselves, okay, wait a minute. We just can't keep going. What are we going to do, have like 400 people on stage and have like 6,000 bassoons and everything? We can't do that. And people had to start looking at expenses because by this time, people weren't just playing for royalty and things like that, but they were playing for the middle class and people to come to the orchestras. And orchestra institutions had to find out ways to finance this. And it was very expensive to get professional players who were on had the capacity to play this. So the idea became to reduce orchestras, and that also caused composers to look back to earlier forms and see how could we put new wine into old bottles.
I also think of the influence of World War I, too, where you lost the cream of a generation.
That's right.
I mean, we can't forget that in France, in England, in Germany, a whole generation was pretty much lost to the war. So it's like it's not as if there are a tremendous number of musicians available
right.
at that
yes,
point.
A lot of people, yes, whose lives were lost. And so, you know, with all of these factors coming together and smaller orchestras, some of these composers like Stravinsky, like Ravel, started to look back to earlier forms. And that had to also do with structure like classical forms, but also affected it in terms of instrumentation, how many instruments we use, and then how to find new colors with combinations of instruments. And that's where a master orchestrator can really come in with how can you make like a new instrument by combining these two instruments. And of course, Mahler did that a lot too in the end of the 19th century, early 20th century as well. So I think that hearkening back to earlier forms, but injecting kind of a new modernism to it, is really a fascinating and creative way to deal with that.
Well, certainly Ravel is a master orchestrator, and you hear that to great effect in Le Tombeau de Couperin.
Yeah,
let's hear a little bit of that first movement you were talking about with the oboe the oboe excerpt there.
That's a great
let's
one.
Hear music from Couperin by Ravel, which will be performed by the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra tomorrow evening. It's music by Ravel, which will be performed by the Tulsa Symphony. And my guest today, Daniel Heggie, the principal guest conductor of the Tulsa Symphony. He leads the orchestra in works by Beethoven, two by Ravel, and Mendelssohn Saturday evening at the Performing Arts Center. Well, that one Ravel is one type of Ravel. And then the other piece is it an earlier piece than Couperin?
Or it's actually a little bit later.
Later, so, that's what I was going to say. So, but it sounds like late Romantic.
Yeah, it does. It's kind of like late Romantic, post-Romantic, you might say. So he wrote, he started the Couperin, Le Tombeau de Couperin around 1914, started kind of put the finishing touches for the piano version of it in 1917. And then in 1919 is when he really had the orchestra version. So 5 years later, Sagan comes out and he attends this concert where this gypsy violinist is playing, Hungarian violinist is playing. And he's so taken with her, Erányi is her name, that he said, "Will you come and play gypsy melodies for me? Just play." And so she played for him, and they played into the wee hours of the night till like 5 in the morning. She's just playing, and he's just like dictating and getting ideas and asking what's possible, and writing all this down. And then out of that session that he had with her, he wrote Tsigan, which literally means gypsy. It actually, you could just say gypsy. That's what the name of the piece is, but we say Tsigan. And it's very interesting because it's about 10 minutes long. But the first 5 minutes are just cadenza by the solo violin. The orchestra's just sitting there. So the cadenza, which oftentimes in classical works happen, or even romantic pieces, happens toward the end of the first movement. So you hear all the exposition, all that stuff, and then the cadenza. This cadenza happens right at the opening. So it's just going to be Rosica, our concertmaster, who's just brilliant, who's a great, great player. And we're so fortunate to have her with the orchestra and to play a solo with us. She'll be playing for 5 minutes, just her. And then there's this harp cadenza that comes in. It's very short, only, you know, maybe 15, 20 seconds with the violin. And then we go into the piece kind of proper with the orchestra. And it's a set of variations, basically. And she's doing all kinds of virtuosic things during that time. I mean, it's these high harmonics and doing fast left-hand pizzicato and all of this stuff that really shows off the violinist. I mean, you've got to have a tremendous virtuoso to play this work. So, yeah, it comes a little bit later, but only about 5 years after. He wrote it for piano and violin first and then orchestrated it only a few months later.
Right. It's, what's interesting, though, is it follows that French Romantic fascination with gypsy culture.
Yes. Yeah, it's true.
I mean, you look, you know, all sorts of French composers write gypsy pieces, as they would refer to it. Yeah. Even, and I think of Sarasate, who was really Spanish, but really was in Paris.
Yeah, right.
French for all intents and purposes. And they're all writing pieces about the Romani culture, Romani music.
I think it lends itself so well to a kind of virtuosity and a color, you know, harmonic kind of color, too, and certain kinds of effects that you don't encounter in lots of other music.
Well, so the scales, the gypsy scales or the Romani scales were the flatted second and the flatted sixth.
I mean, I think it just opened a world up to them, like, wow, we could use this as great source material. Mm-hmm. You know, of course, Bartok, was able to do that. Is more of his native land, of course, but still able to explore kind of the folk side of things and all those, like you said, different scales and imbuing different colors in it through harmony and melody. And that's what Ravel does in this Tsigan.
Well, contrast those two pieces and the Mendelssohn back to the Beethoven Symphony No. 4.
Yes.
Now, what was it about doing this particular symphony? Because you well know when people say program a Beethoven symphony, it's 3, 5, 6, 7, or 9.
Right.
But really, 4 doesn't get done that much. Because if you're going to do a Beethoven symphony, you do one of the big
exactly.
ones.
Exactly. You hit the nail on the head. When Beethoven springs to mind, out of the 9 symphonies, out of the corpus of his 9 symphonies, people jump right to the big famous ones. And because they're not even played that often, I mean, every time you play Third Symphony, it's probably 4 or 5 years in between. And so it's not like it's all the time that you're hearing these pieces live. And so it's very precious every time that you give a Beethoven slot in a program for a season, any orchestra season. For that reason, 1, 2, 4, and 8 just don't get played too much, but they are just simply overlooked. I mean, they are just as brilliant in I think, in every way. They don't speak as directly, or they don't have the grandness. You can say the 4th isn't like the 3rd or the 5th in terms of its just sheer force, But it is just every bit as clever. And I think if you would have found a composer like Clementi or someone at the turn of the century who had written something like this, you'd have scholars and musicians everywhere saying this is a masterpiece and it would be played all the time. Oh, it's new Clementi's symphony,
Right.
And it would be the one that would be right up there with Beethoven and all the others.
They only suffer by comparison.
Exactly. It's always, and I say this, I said that even to the orchestra last night. I said, well, it's great to do Beethoven 4th. I said, Beethoven had this rare problem of being in competition with himself because people gravitate to these others. But it doesn't diminish the works that aren't played as much. It's just that the other ones are also so great. So I think it's wonderful to shed light on a piece like this. I mean, the 1st and the 2nd, the 8th are also, they're masterpieces. So anyway, this piece is just so clever. It's so much lighter in nature than, let's say, the third or the fifth, the pieces surrounding it. He seemed to have written it fairly quickly, and scholars note that he didn't use so many sketches. Like you can find in his sketchbooks, you can see how he wrote and rewrote and rewrote. But this seemed to just pour out of him, kind of more like how we consider Mozart did it, just kind of writing it out. And yet, in terms of form and structure, it's everything is there. And there's so much humor, as I mentioned, like, you know, the scherzo movement, which is really a full-blooded scherzo. It's not just a minuet. And Beethoven was in the process of changing that in his symphonies, going from the minuet from Haydn and Mozart into something that's really more full-bodied, like the scherzo. And even in the last movement where you have this moto perpetuo, this, you know, perpetual motion of the violins just going digga 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 digga, just constantly all the way through, there's a real sense of humor with that as well. The second movement is actually extremely creative in some of the harmonic areas he goes to as well. But see, people don't have to know all these things that I'm saying, like harmonic areas and this and that, because the drama of the piece speaks for itself. If they're simply listening to the rhetoric that Beethoven has put out there in terms of how he wrote the piece, I mean, there's a lot of suspense. The way it opens, for example, in this kind of very solemn, almost mystical way, you think, oh, he's setting it up for something very serious. But that's part of the humor, too. Sometimes I think he sets something up like, oh, this is important stuff, folks. And then he's, it's so jaunty and just so happy, and yet so much invention in there. My blood starts to race just thinking about it.
Well, you know, the thing about it is you have to remember when you put 4 and 5 together, 4 and 5 overlap as far as their composition. Mm-hmm. And you think, here's two sides of a personality. You have 5 where, you know, I'm grappling with fate. This is the most important thing in the world. And 4 is, hey, I'm having a great day.
Yeah, it is. It's just lighthearted and actually coming after the third, too, where it also seemed like he's really struggling with something. And we know that as early as 1802, he was already struggling with the deafness that was really getting a hold of him. And he was really in despair about that. We know that from his note, that Heiligenstadt Testament, where it's almost a suicide note. I mean, you can see that Beethoven was really in the depths of despair. And here this is a few years later, and it's like, I don't know, it's almost like he's looking for the music to release him from that. And so he finds this incredible joy and sunniness in this wonderful symphony.
Well, let's hear a little bit of the Beethoven 4. What would you recommend?
I love the last movement. I think that just says so much. I mean, that's just fast all the way through. It's hard to ask me because I would say any of them. The beginning is wonderful because you hear that contrast of the slow introduction of that very solemn kind of searching, and then it just breaks away into this very fast race almost.
Well, why don't we hear the opening of the final movement?
Great.
Here's music by Beethoven from the Symphony No. 4. The Tulsa Symphony will be performing it tomorrow night at 7:30 at the Tulsa PAC. That's music by Beethoven, which will be performed by the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra with my guest today, Daniel Heggie, principal guest conductor of the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra. In a program that will include that Beethoven Symphony No. 4, two works by Ravel, and overture by Mendelssohn that takes place Saturday night at 7:30 at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center's Chapman Music Hall. You're obviously getting this great relationship with the orchestra. Coming in every so often, you have your own orchestras and you have your own other guest conducting duties and other orchestras you're involved with. What's it like when you come to Tulsa as sort of the principal guest conductor?
And, you know, it really feels more like family and like friends when I come back each time. I mean, it's just a real joy to make music with them. They love making music. They love working hard and making the art as great as it can be. They help programming these. I mean, they actually program these pieces and these programs themselves. And so they have real ownership about it. And I feel like each time that we work together, we just get a little bit deeper with that musical relationship. They know some of the expectations I'm looking for. I know some of the things that they have to contribute. And we start working together right away. And I think each time we start, it starts a little bit on a higher level in terms of just being able to communicate with each other. And I really love them.
Now, when you're usually doing a guest conductor gig, the programming is all put out for you. Now, when you're a music director, you obviously have some say in choosing that. Are you equally happy with either approach?
I am. I find that it's really great to enable the players who know a lot of the repertoire to get them to weigh in on a lot of the programs.
Do you get any ideas yourself for your own programming?
Well, I get to be on the artistic team occasionally when I'm in town, when they have the meetings. And I'm there just like one of the musicians. I'm not there to wield any more power as principal guest conductor, as anyone who's sitting in the viola section or the clarinet section or anyone else. I'm just there amongst all of them. And sometimes they'll say, you know, you might think about this or you might consider this. And I'll just put a couple, you know, because sometimes they're thinking of a piece and they can't quite remember it, or I'll just put it out there and I'll say, well, that one's a little bit long. If you put those two on the first half, oh, yeah, okay. I mean, it's things that we could consult in a book.
It's technical stuff, too. It's also, I mean, as a music director, you know, okay, you're talking about three pieces that have large orchestras but different instrumentation, so you're going to have to hire extra players and it's going to cost
more. Little things just to mention to them. But I would, you know, I never – ever. And I would never think of doing this, like putting my foot down kind of thing and saying, look, it's got to be this way. No, I just kind of put it out there, something to consider. In terms of rehearsal time, this will be a little bit tighter here. You might have to do an overtime if you did this or something like that, just to kind of put those kinds of things out there because I'm experienced with doing those kinds of things.
And so I know this is going to be a busy winter and spring for you. Of course, you're coming back several other times during the year. What are you looking forward to this year as far as conducting?
Well, you know, in Wichita, I'm doing Mahler's Seventh.
Wow.
And that Mahler symphony doesn't get done too often.
Well, that doesn't.
So I'm really excited. You should come up for it. Just come up and listen to it because it doesn't, you know, people don't hear it live too often. So it's always interesting to do something epic, you know, like that. But I'm really looking forward to the other concert when I come back here, too. We're doing Stravinsky Firebird 1945, which isn't done too often. You know, that's sweet. And Herianos we're doing on that program as well. And I love that piece. Oh, there's just so many. I mean, all of them, really. Mahler 7 is the one that's probably the most out of the box kind of thing.
Right. Well, we wish you great success with the program this weekend. Beethoven, Ravel, and Mendelssohn at the PAC Saturday night. Daniel Heggie, thanks very much for joining.
Great to be here, Rich. Thank you.
Tulsa Symphony Orchestra principal guest conductor Daniel Heggie speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He'll lead the TSO in the Beethoven Symphony No. 4, two works by Ravel, and the Mendelssohn's Hebride Overture tomorrow evening at 7:30 at the Chapman Music Hall of the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. For ticket information and details about the concert, visit tulsasymphony.org. Well, at Studio Tulsa for today, we're going to leave you with a little more music by Ravel. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.